Welcome to Coaching Uncaged by Animas, the podcast that explores the art, science, and career of coaching. And now, introducing your host and interviewer, Yannick Jacob.
Right. David Rothauser, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much, Yannick. Happy to be here. Looking forward to this.
Yes, me too. We had a short kind of connection point, and I've already got in touch with kind of the quality of your thinkings, which made me really excited to have you on here and jump a little bit more into depth. What can I say about you? You've done so many things. It's quite impressive. You seem to have worked in so many industries. You just kind of threw in that you used to be work in shoe manufacturing. As a coach, some of the areas like industries that you've listed, I mean, they go all over the place. And the quality of your training is really impressive as well. You've studied Columbia University executive coaching. You've done coaching supervision at Oxford Brookes. That's with Tatiana Bachkarova, no? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had her on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. What a wonderful woman. Very, very critical. So really, really good course. You've studied psychodynamic group leadership, and you've studied psychoanalysis. So what a wonderful range of really in-depth training. That's quite exciting. So you still work as a psychoanalyst, right?
That's true. Yep.
And as an executive coach, and you do work with teams. There's so much. You've written a book as well recently, a book chapter on group supervision with executive coaches from a psychodynamic perspective.
This is true.
That is really interesting. Is there more to know about David that might be helpful for coaches out there that kind of trying to make sense where you're speaking from?
I think so. Right. So I think you have it in a nutshell. I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm an executive and team coach, and I do a lot of supervision work with executive coaches and other kinds of coaches. I thought it would be fun to tell you about where. Right. So I'm a dual trained practitioner in a way. I live deeply in at least two worlds. The world of psychoanalysis can seem impenetrable or from the outside. But I thought maybe I could tell you where these come from in me psychically.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
I was
yeah.
thinking about that before our conversation. But let's just say, so I grew up in a loving but chaotic family where it was clear to me from an early age that something unspoken was driving the confusing behaviors. And I can remember from an early age thirsting to make sense for sense. And so when I made it to university, I gravitated to the study of philosophy and its way of making sense of the world. And it was really a natural leap at some point in my life from that early university academic training in philosophy to psychoanalysis.
Any particular philosophy that you were into at the time?
What I gravitated towards was courses in logic, and then ultimately mathematical logic, and more 20th century contemporary philosophy. And I think there was something about the thinking itself that was very enlivening to my mind. And with psychoanalysis, which holds as a basic premise that there's an unconscious, and that there's always some rationale for what seems to be irrational on the surface, that to me suited my character. And this is not linear. I'll say that when I was working as a teacher in New York City public schools, which is what I did beyond university, right? And when I was doing that work, I was searching for professional development that would help me become more skillful as a leader, as a group leader of my classroom with all of its emotional dynamics. My sister at that time was becoming a social worker. And I was envious of the kind of professional training available in her field. So if you wanted to become a much more skillful couples therapist, she could go do a postgraduate institute. I didn't in that, or a, you know, family therapy. You could spend 4 years training beyond graduate school. And I didn't find what I saw in her field, I didn't see in my field. The training, the professional development, the support was much more behaviorally oriented. So I stumbled into a training program at the Center for Group Studies. I didn't know it at the time, but that program has a psychoanalytic underpinning. But it's a training in group leadership, the psychodynamic group leadership. It's training how to work with yourself as an instrument, as a group leader. And they didn't require that I had a mental health license to go learn. And so the learning itself was very rich early in my career. And so that was sort of another place that all of this came from in me psychically, I guess. And since supervision is such a core component of psychoanalytic training and practice, I really availed myself of it as a tool in my various roles before becoming a coach. When I was a teacher, and then when I was a leadership coach and a coach, supervision and my own personal analysis really became places for me to do the deep understanding work required by my professional roles, but also the developmental work to flourish and advance in my career and my broader life. And so, yeah, I think those are like pretty core parts of my story.
I'd love to ask more about what does it mean to use yourself as an instrument, but I'd love to park that for a little bit later.
Sure.
Can I choose? I was curious, given that you've worked across so many different industries, I wonder as a coach, how did you get in there? Because so many coaches ask themselves, how do I get into industry? And when I see someone who's worked across so many different industries, but doesn't necessarily have the super corporate background that, you know, in consulting that connected them to all of that, I'm always curious how as a coach, I mean, maybe you want to get into how you got into coaching from where you just left off, but particularly curious about how do you get such a spread and such a range of clients in such a broad variety of industries?
I think there are two parts to that story. One, so it's true. I grew up after university, I became a science teacher in New York City public schools. And then through my training, I started working more and more with adults, and I took on adult development roles, working as a coach, a leadership coach with school principals and their leadership teams. Right. And that was all, when I had a job, I was working internally. And so when I decided to go into, and that was all in one sector, deeply in the education sector. And I'll say that I have a bias, which is that I think in the education sector, the kind of learning and development that goes on and like the appetite for learning and the criticality about pedagogy and development itself is awesome. I love working in the education sector. But when I went into business for myself and left the world of, you know, having a job to making a job for myself, one of my problems of practice was how do I expand out beyond the education sector without having had the corporate experience or the corporate experiences? And so one of the things I did was, I think two things were really important. I found coach trainings for myself that would help me encounter people and make relationships with people who had different paths than I did. And that was very important to me. I'm sometimes I have said I'm terrible at marketing, right? But really, my business development strategy has really always ever been make real relationships with people that I want to spend time with, right? So so you have to put yourself in places where you're going to be able to make real relationships with people that you like. So I mean, that's sort of vague, but in a way, that was really helpful to me, actually, finding trainings where I thought I'd meet people that had different paths than I did. And and so that was helpful. And then another thing I did was I got myself into one of these coach brokerages, essentially, that would find me.
An agency directory kind of thing.
So, you know, in a way, we can like, I have some cynicism about these kinds of corporate tactics for commodifying coaching, but I thought it would be helpful to me to build my experience base outside of my sector to get myself connected to an organization that would feed me clients from other sectors. And so I found an organization that really valued my background as an analyst and as an educator. Mm-hmm. And I did that for years. And so, you know, if you do something for years, then you have the experience, you give yourself a different set of experiences. So that's sort of like one piece of it. It was sort of on a tactical, strategic level, but also well, I'm hesitating a little. And I sometimes don't know how to tell this story because there are many pieces to it. But my father was a business owner. He was always a business owner. He was in the diamond business. Mm-hmm. And so I saw my father as a small business owner. I worked very closely with him. He did... So there was manufacturing that went on when I was a teenager, working in his shop, always with him being, I guess, the chief executive, you could say, of a small business. I had 5 employees, 12 employees, whatever. And so in a lot of ways, as a kid, I had a front row seat to some of the stresses and the anxieties of the chief entrepreneurial position, right? Mm-hmm. It was through my father. And then when I started out in the work world somewhat early when I was 15, 16, 17. Work was very compelling to me. And I went to trade school before university and worked in a very downstream way in like shoe manufacturing and plastics manufacturing, doing design work and print production work. And so I think it's actually been very important to me in my work with the senior most executives, like having had experiences early in my career working as a worker.
I'd love to take two steps back for a moment, because you mentioned people who would appreciate your psychoanalytic background. And I know there's former or current therapists listening to this who kind of really curious about coaching. My wife is a psychoanalyst, a Lacanian psychoanalyst, who went into organizational consulting and leadership consulting. In the beginning, it was like, well, I don't really want to tell people that I'm a therapist coming into this because, you know, a lot of people I know, they struggle to see how they can communicate it in a way that people see the relevance of it when it's so blatantly obvious to everybody who knows about this kind of stuff, how relevant it is whenever you work with anybody. So could you frame for us why psychoanalysis is relevant and important, not just for coaches, but like in organizations, for leaders when working with groups? What's the value of it that would get a coach to be really excited about, oh, I want to know more about this stuff because clearly this matters when I work with people?
Yeah. First of all, all right, this is going to go all over the place, but I'll try to focus it. Psychoanalysis as a discipline makes a lot of sense to people who've had a personal analysis. Psychoanalytic concepts, the premises, the principles, the way of working, the study method comes from inside of a practice. Right. And I think something happens in the coaching world where psychoanalysis itself, which is not a unitary discipline, it's a field that has many strands of thought and practice.
Like coaching.
Right? It's like coaching. So to represent psychoanalysis broadly would in some way I don't want to get on board with the idea that I can represent psychoanalysis.
Like, it's not one thing.
Yeah. I've trained in a strand in the psychoanalytic world called modern psychoanalysis, and I can talk about that and its relationship to the broader field and what it was trying to do when it started and how it looks now and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But like, I think it's important to think about what we mean when we're applying concepts, mm-hmm. psychodynamic concepts and practice to the world of, you know, to organizations and our work with executives. I don't think, so I can say what has been applicable for me, and, you know, but I can't say that it is sort of objectively important.
That makes sense. Let's start there then for a moment. What sets modern psychoanalysis apart from maybe the classic Freudian psychoanalysis, the kind of origins of psychology when it's delivered one-to-one?
Sure. Modern psychoanalysis got its start in the 40s and 50s when someone named Hyman Spotnitz was working at the Jewish Board of Guardians with people who were then called schizophrenic, mm-hmm. ambulatory schizophrenics, who were considered unanalyzable. Mm-hmm. So in mainstream psychoanalysis at that time in New York City, there was scholarship around who was and wasn't suited for psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis was, it was like the sine qua non of, you know, mental health treatment at that time. And so there was, right, thinking about who it could and couldn't apply to. And so Spotnitz was somewhat of a maverick. And through his own personal analysis and supervision, developed a technique while he was working with schizophrenics that he thought, where he modified classical technique to work with what he called the narcissistic transference. Mm-hmm. So classical psychoanalysts brought people in to work five times a week on the couch, and they worked with what is more like an Oedipal or an object transference, which means that I might relate to you, for instance, as my father of the past. We would call mm-hmm. that a more of an object transference. But there's an aspect of transference, which I think is important in the coaching world, which emanates from a time before there was language itself. Mm-hmm. In modern psychoanalysis, they call that the narcissistic transference.
Mm-hmm. Can you just frame transference quickly for people who might not be familiar with the term?
Sure. It's the living past. Transference is the basic idea that we relate to. There's an aspect in where we relate in the present moment to people. Our expectations of people are based on our experiences in the past. Mm-hmm. So our earliest experiences have helped shape our mental models of what people are going to be like, mm-hmm. and those inform how we lead meetings at work. They inform how we think about relationship work. They inform how we what's possible when we encounter inevitable conflict with our colleagues or mm-hmm. with our lovers.
Mm-hmm. Or a coaching client comes into the room and we feel that they're super committed and they're going to do great, versus another one who we get a sense that, oh yeah, they're not going to follow through with this. There's something triggered of our past relationships that might get us this sense.
That the coach's transference is a feature mm-hmm. too, for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah. So modern psychoanalysis, that was its roots, but mm-hmm. really all of psychoanalysis has really undergone a lot of development since. I think modern psychoanalysis is kind of a terrible name for
something that started in the 40s.
For something that started in the 40s and 50s. Because actually now contemporary psychoanalysts have pretty much all modified their technique for working with all sorts of phenomena in the treatment room. And, there's this idea we talk about the relational turn in psychoanalysis, where we shifted in thinking about people from a one person to a two person psychology. This is the intersubjective turn where where psychoanalysts now, for the most part, in all schools of thought, really are working with mind more generally, and really working with two psyches, the psyche of the analyst and the psyche of the analysand, is what we call it in psychoanalysis. And I think that's applicable in coaching. And for me, I think modern psychoanalysis, why it's important, or why some of those ideas about working with the earlier transference states, is because when we work with leaders, we all inhabit these states of mind. When there's anxiety, when there's regression, when there's pressure, these early parts of self come out to play in the coaching room and in the boardroom. And so modern psychoanalysis in my career, as I've applied it in my classroom, as I've applied it as a leadership, you know, it's been helpful to me as a technique, as a really a theory of technique that can be applied more broadly than, in fact, I was training and working before I was working with patients as a therapist. I was doing this work as a coach and as an educator. So, I would say that personally, for me, it's been important to think about translation from one field to another, to apply this in my work, in my role.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to dig a little bit more into how this shows up in your coaching. I know you do group work. There might be supervision, right? You do a lot of supervision these days. So let's maybe broader, when you work with people, when there's a coaching or coaching supervision had attached to it, how do these concepts, and feel free to name specific ones or specific examples, how could you illustrate how this looks like in practice in the coaching room?
I would have to think of a client. Do you have a client that comes to your mind?
Anything specific you're looking for?
Well, a client where you imagine some of these concepts might be at play.
Yeah, just pick one.
Okay. Well, maybe we could do this together. Let's think about somebody that you'd feel comfortable talking about in general terms, and we can think together about what psychodynamic principles might lead us to a richer understanding. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, that sounds great. I've just opened my book, and as coincidence has it, I landed at a client that you're familiar with because you've been observing me working with her. So I've ran a coaching lab where I have a client who's recently lost her mother. She died. And she came into the coaching relationship wanting to leave or radically change the way that she works and the work that she does. And something that seemed to really matter, and there might be more, and I'm curious what you think, just because you've been sitting in on these sessions, there were three or four now. There was something about her relationship with men in her industry, or the treatment of women, particular women in leadership positions. And there seemed to have been a lot of stuff around how she relates to both real people in her field, but also to the concept of women in leadership position. And there's some stuff going on for me in terms of how I relate to that. And then there's stuff going on around how we relate to each other, you know, her being a woman, me being a man. So I'm curious to kind of activate your lens, your psychoanalytic lens on this, because I work in a particular way, and I'm sure there's like plenty of openings that you would have kind of explored into where I probably chose a different path. So that might be something interesting to explore.
I think it is, and it would. I'm hesitant to talk about that case, actually, because I am observing you work with this person live. My my sense is that it would be hard, it would be easier for us to do, to illustrate something with a case that I don't know anything about.
Ah, interesting.
And the reason is because I think in supervision, really we're working with the coach and the fiction that they bring into the room.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say fiction?
Because anytime you bring a client into the room, you're telling a story about something out there through filtered through mm-hmm. your psyche, your system. And so mm-hmm. there's a way in which we're working with fiction. So that mm-hmm. is not to say there's not an objective reality, mm-hmm. but it's the subjective reality that that in some way needs to get worked with to be most sort of helpful.
And I think this in itself illustrates it quite well. I'm not sure if we need to get sure. into the detail
into
because
that case, but the yeah.
Because the fact that you're, from your perspective, it's always fiction, it's always a story that is filtered through the filters of that particular coach and the filter system of that particular coach, the interpretation system, the way that they perceive what's going on and choose to retell it in a particular way. You know, that is so colored by who is that coach as a person and what were their past relationships like and how did they grow up?
Mm-hmm. And what gets stimulated in them with this particular case? Like, why is this case interesting to talk about or important to talk about now?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be helpful to say that psychoanalysis, well, I think one of the stereotypes of psychoanalysis is that it uses the tool of interpretation mm-hmm. to help make the unconscious conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people think about psychoanalysis, they think about an analyst making sense out of someone's psyche and then telling them about it.
Mm-hmm. Like Freud often did, right?
Like Freud often did. But I think that myth about, you know, the major tool in psychoanalysis persists.
Unfortunately.
I'd like to dispel some of that and say that interpretation happens all the time. What I mean by interpretation, so in a lot of ways, modern psychoanalysis is more of an implicit method. We go really light on interpretation and lean heavily on working more implicitly. We might make interventions, but rarely do we make an interpretation, which is about you know telling someone about themselves. But we're always making meaning. And I think coaches are always making meaning, making sense. And at the heart of an interpretation, which is a verbal utterance where you tell someone about themselves, mm-hmm. Is some meaning that you've made inside of yourself, mm-hmm. right? And so that internal meaning that we're always making out of what we're seeing and why is crucial in this work. And so if we think about psychoanalysis more as a research method, a participant observer way of studying what is happening in the coaching room.
Mm-hmm.
When I do this move, what do I get in return? Mm-hmm. And what is there to study in the coaching room?
Mm-hmm.
There are observations with our five senses, but then there are observations about what gets stimulated inside of us, mm-hmm. our feelings, our fantasies, our associations. And mm-hmm. So in supervision, I try to create a space where we can freely play with and study the coach's observations and expand their observational capacity so that, and in fact, I lean more heavily on understanding than on intervention, because I find that when we can work together to help a coach, to help us make more meaning, make more sense out of what's being seen and observed, mm-hmm. Creative ideas about what to do next abound.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's fascinating. I want to ask about a second big conception of psychoanalysis, sure. which is, well, you go into the past and you explore people's childhoods, right? We had Jerry Colonna on the podcast who In his coaching, very freely goes to how did you grow up and how did you form, because these are really, really important narratives. And as you say, our early relationships, they really shape our psychic structure. But then hearing you talk about it now, it seems very clear that, well, we work with what's present, what's right in front of us. And if I do this, this kind of stuff comes out. So I wonder, what's the balance, if any? Do you go to the past? Do you explore early relationships? Or is it really happening all right in front of you? And some of the past shows up in the now, and that's why you're exploring it. Like, do you go to the past? Is that still coaching? Is that something you do? Mm-hmm.
Well, let's just say that in my coaching and in the way I supervise, it's I work in a principled way, but there's not a set process. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's really important to consider what that means. So in general, I will work with, I tend to work with people where they are. That's a principle. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has an appetite for making links in their mind between what's happening now and experiences they've had in the past, I will go there. Mm-hmm. But I've certainly had and I certainly have interest and curiosity about how you got to be here. And people tend to reveal parts of themselves when they want to. I am very open as a coach and as a supervisor to where somebody wants to go. Mm-hmm. And I think because I'm a dual trained practitioner and I have a ton, you know, as a therapist and an analyst and as a coach, I am very open to like, you want to talk about the past, that's fine. I'm not worried. Yeah, I think I'll pick up on that piece. I'm less worried about whether we're doing therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, because you're trained, you don't have to be.
No, not because I'm trained. If you're paying me for coaching, mm-hmm. if your company is paying me for coaching, you can talk about whatever you want. I'm going to get interested in it. But in my mind, we're coaching, mm-hmm. right? In some way, I think the context governs whether it's therapy or coaching more than the moves we make or the temporality of the talk. And I think that's one of the really overly simplistic ways that the coaching world has attempted to define itself. But by doing that, they've created a straw man out of the therapy world and by saying, you know, the realm of therapy is the past and coaching is about the present and future. So I don't sit people down and say, tell me about your past. But in an intake with a coaching client, I might ask things like, can you tell me what experiences you've had of coaching and or of therapy? Mm-hmm. How have you used dialogic talking through helping relationships in your life? And something like that tends to open up dialogue about the past and about relationships and how I ask for help, how I get help, how I consider helping myself in it, so there's that. And also I'll say that for people who don't want to talk about their past, I've certainly worked with more than one CEO who has specifically legislated that what we do in here is about business strategy and the problems I'm having with my team and da da da, you know. Mm-hmm. And so in some way, my curiosity about the past is mine alone, right? There's not curiosity about that. But I'm thinking of one person in particular where I have felt so strongly that issues around authority and needing to make it go my way emanated from an early place in life. And so mm-hmm. that, you know, for this particular executive I'm thinking of, collaboration itself was threatening.
Hmm.
You have to wonder why. What is it about allowing others' ideas to inform your own that is intolerable? Where does that come from in somebody?
Yeah. Well, and then you wonder and you might, you know, you get curious, but this person just doesn't want to go there.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it? I would imagine that feeling really frustrating or restricting. And I'm thinking about a supervisee in a group who brought a client that sounded quite similar, a person who just said very clearly, you know, I don't want to go into the past. The past is the past. You can't change it anyway. You know, I want to do this kind of stuff. I'm looking forward. And it felt really restrictive.
So what?
I mean, that coach was asking himself, is this like, if somebody's cutting off that line of inquiry, am I willing and able to work with this person? Right. And I think that's a fair question, right? If somebody doesn't have an interest in exploring past relationships and it's so clear that their past relationships influence their current relationships and they want to work on their current relationships, but they don't want to look at the thing that's going to help them figure that stuff out. Mm-hmm. It's like you somebody's asking you to help, but they tie your hands.
Right. There's room here to talk about the psychodynamic concept of resistance. Mm-hmm. Right. So in a way, it sounds like you're describing a client who is using a particular mode of relating. They're governing what can and can't be talked about, or what they will and won't do in the room. So. Why? What is resistance in the service of? It's in the service of learning. It's in the service of self-protection. So we have to think about those living parts of the personality. It sounds like that coach, filled up with feelings of frustration, was actually feeling something important in the client's life, right? There was some emotional communication. Mm-hmm. The coach was attempting to make moves with the client, and the client was and am I foiling their efforts? So that's what we can get interested in. So I think coaches in the coaching field, we think this is actually quite pernicious, this idea of coachability. It gets used in the coaching world in a lot of ways, I think, prematurely. We end up blaming clients for not being coachable, when in fact, we haven't figured out a way to work with them that lowers their anxiety enough so that they can be open with us. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes for coaching and they say they want coaching. I'm open to their resistances. I need to know. I welcome their resistances because in a way that's their way of telling me something about their story. The way they resist in the coaching room is the way they resist outside of the coaching room. So that's another lens, I guess, a psychodynamic concept, but that we have all, you know, broadly with parallel process. We have to think about what's happening in the room as an expression of what's happening outside of the room. Mm-hmm. So again, this client is of yours is saying, what should I do? You know, I don't know if I can work with them. They're going right to the action that I call that intervention. Should I fire this client? I feel terrible with them, right? So I would be inclined to back it up and say, well, let's lay off for a month. I mean, you're welcome to fire them, but the opportunity in supervision really is to understand what the hell is happening. Mm-hmm. If we can make meaning of what might be happening for your client, for you, in between the two of you, you might have some new ideas about, you know, what you want to do with them. So
that would be
my approach.
Yeah, that makes sense. It really illustrates a lot. Tell us a bit more about using yourself as an instrument when you're coaching or supervising.
What can I say? Help me.
I figured it might be a bit too broad.
It gets invoked. So, you know, I think, it gets invoked in a way to talk about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Say more about your interest and I'll respond to that.
Yeah. So, for example, maybe what would be helpful to people who listen to this podcast, we had Robin Shoheid, for example, on the podcast, who very much works with what's going on for him right now in this moment, feelings, emotions, but really kind of drawing on what's created here between us in this relationship. And it makes me think about what you said earlier around, well, self-disclosing things that are well processed. Well, if there's an emotion or an experience coming up, that might not be well processed. You know, we kind of quickly check whether that's my stuff and my parallel process, because this person just reminds me of my brother and that's why I'm so annoyed, you know. But if there's some annoyance or some frustration coming up, he would then share that, put it in the room so we can look at this together. So in the context of this way of using yourself as an instrument, how does what you mean compare?
I will say that I'm a big fan of Robin's work. And it's interesting to me. But I cannot say that I'm an expert on the way that he uses the what he hears inside of himself with his clients. Right. So I suspect that he doesn't share everything. I suspect that he makes choices about what he does share. And those choices are based on hypotheses about why he would share what he shares. That would be in line with my approach. So I think here, this is a little bit like getting in the weeds. It's kind of nerdy, but there's an idea we have.
Good.
There's a way of using what's inside of me. Theoretically, we have the language of objective and subjective countertransference. So transferences are our stuff from the past that emerges in the present. Countertransference is the coach's reaction to that stuff. And objective countertransference is meant to distinguish what is really being transmitted in the room versus what is coming from my history. So some way of talking about subjective countertransference is really talking about the coach's own transference. Now, in reality, we can never measure any of this stuff. So I find it helpful when working in supervision with coaches to say that whatever you're experiencing with your client, let's assume that 90% of it is coming from the outside. It may remind you of something in your history, but the work we're going to do here in this moment is about understanding your coaching case. If you're so distracted by something from your history, let's say that that too, that level of distraction is part of what we're interested in, less than going into your personal history about your brother or whatever. So is that sort of helpful?
This is great. There's so much good stuff in there. And it just really highlights that the only way of working in this way, which is, you know, it gives you a lot of access to things to be curious about, to understanding what's happening between us and understanding the other person's relationship. It's so crucial that we know ourselves. But it's so crucial that we have done our work, explored our shadows, explored our previous relationships, because only then can we distinguish what's being created in this room, in this relationship, and what's being created because of my previous relationships.
I agree and I don't with you. I think the idea that we have had to do our work in order to then be able to do this work in some way sets up a kind of impossible standard. I think that we're always doing our work. And it's important to be engaged in the process of self-development concurrently with doing our coaching work. And what I mean by that is having your own coach, your own therapist, being in supervision while you're doing this work, because doing developmental work with people is going to bring up your stuff. And we all have a lifetime of development behind and ahead of us. And so I like to think about that the coaching work itself can be amazing fuel for our own developmental work. And that, in fact, coaching can be mutually beneficial in that if we make use of what gets stimulated in us with our clients, we can do quite a bit of growing ourselves.
Oh, indeed.
Part of what's exciting here. Well, I want to say one more thing, which is I was thinking as we're talking, like, what is the point of all this jargon? Like, who cares, right? I think the point of it, having some of these tools and working with them, but really the point in supervision is about curiosity and its restoration. I think it's been my experience, my observation, that curiosity in the coach can get messed with. Things can get weird when we work with our clients. Mm-hmm. So much so that, like your example, a supervisee might come in the room and be sort of very rigidly fixed to the, you know, their certainty about whether the real question is, should I get rid of this client? Is this the right client for me? And I'm always assessing the degree to which curiosity is there, and there's freedom to be creative and playful with new kinds of questions and new kinds of perspectives. And so in some way, I think the purpose of, I don't care about the jargon. I care about the quality of creative possibility in the room, right? So when we can get back to a place of getting interested, something important has transpired that is going to be useful. Not that we can then get to more questions, but when we can get to a place of having more questions, something has shifted that's important for being able to go back in the room with the client. In a way, I think this is part of our value as coaches, that part of what we're doing, maybe differently than our clients, is that we're learning. We're always learning how to be effective with a client. Mm-hmm. And that process is a process. We don't know how to work with our clients from the outset, no matter how much training we have, because each human is just utterly unique. So another piece of the puzzle for me is accepting the reality that I don't know what to do. Like all the time.
Yeah, to be able to sit with that and hold it together, holding that space, I think that's such an important, well, I don't want to call it a skill, but in some ways it's a skill, right? It's also a mindset, a perspective that we hold, a principle to be okay sitting with that and sitting in that and holding space for people to sit in that.
I've heard from you the idea of trusting the process. I think it's the same idea, you know, so the growing comfortable with having uncomfortable feelings, growing, you know, getting help, growing comfortable with the reality that I just don't know what's going to come next. And I don't know the best next question. I don't know what's going to be useful to you. I have to learn all those things with your help. Mm-hmm. Like that's.
Yeah. And I mean, I know you don't care about the jargon, but I'd love to throw another piece of jargon at you.
Sure.
Because
what I'm saying is I don't care about the jargon in practice. You were asking about to what degree is psychoanalysis important for like executives or CEOs or whatever. I think working with people in their own language is crucial.
Yeah.
It's crucial to being able to work.
I think the end of that sentence is exactly what I want to ask you about, because I read the terminology developmental transformation in one of your bios, that's what you help create. And obviously we're a school of transformative coaching. I ask all of my guests about what their take on transformation is. So I think you said a lot about it already, but could you frame this a bit more? I think you've already framed it, but I don't want to make that assumption necessarily.
I don't know if I can frame it more. Let me think. Yeah. So the Animas is a school of transformational coaching.
We've moved to transformative, right? Because part of the conversation was transformational, and transformation seems to be whatever people want it to be. And the move to transformative was to kind of ground it more in existing theory. A lot of that is based on Jack Masaroff's work, but like there was a feeling, and we had a couple of critical voices in the podcast. You mentioned Simon Weston, we mentioned Tatiana Bachkarova, that this word transformation seems to be something that is thrown around quite lightly and sometimes thrown around quite seriously and somewhat toxically. I also used that, well, you're cynical about some of the coaching industry, but when you say developmental transformation, I have a feeling that's not something that is just whatever people want it to be, that there's something grounded behind it that you bring about with this kind of process.
does sound kind of catchy, doesn't it?
It does sound catchy, yeah. I guess the question is, what is it to you? If somebody were to say, a client would come up to you and say, you know, some executive, some coaching client, maybe a coach, and would say, hey, I've read that you help people create developmental transformation. I want to know more about that. I think I want that. Well, what is it to you?
If you were saying that to me, I would say, I'm so happy to meet you. And I really want to know what that is to you. Why is that important? Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what it is to me, really. Mm-hmm. I don't have a definition. I can say this, that I think across all of the work I've ever done in my life, development, human development has played a key role. It's been a major focus. And I think, let's just say that all, you know, we're developing all the time. Some people want to make it go faster. I don't know that there's such a thing, actually. I think sometimes developmental transformation can occur when we help somebody slow down enough to be right where they are, so that rather than skipping over getting the kind of getting some developmental need met because they're trying to go so fast, they actually get the thing, you know, they get the thing they need. You know, it's like with. I have a 3.5-month-old daughter who can't yet roll over fully. And so it would be weird for me to like hold her up and try to make her walk. She can push up and stand up when I'm holding her, but like, she's not ready for it crawling. You know, like there's something, there are little micro muscles that need to be built that are going to happen, you know, on their own time. I realize this is a largely unsatisfying answer, but I'm not in the dialogue about, I just think about transformation as change, right? Mm-hmm. In some way, it's a neutral word. It could be positive change. It could be negative change. But clearly, when we're talking about developmental transformation, we're talking about growth itself. But I think growth on a more human level, growth around what's needed as opposed to what's wanted. I think one of the one of the pieces of the coaching world, in a way, sometimes I think we have a way of marketing ourselves or selling to people what's wanted, you know, career success, whatever it is. But typically, and there's a way to think about what's wanted as is something that's needed, but I have the idea that when we get more of what we need in a helping relationship, we can, we're freer to explore the world and in some way use having had what we need to get more of what we want.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making this up on the spot. You know?
I think it's excellent, right? Because what it tells me is that there are some things that we put out there because we know people respond to it, right? And it starts a conversation. And I don't think, I agree that we don't need to have everything super well defined. When somebody responds to something and it starts a conversation, we get an opportunity to hold space for them so they can figure some of that stuff out. And, you know, in most cases that I know of, it really doesn't matter what our own definition of this, that, and the other is, especially when we're actually coaching, right? Because they're not coming for some sort of training or mentoring or you to educate them about this or that terminology or concept or language, you know, they come to figure something out. And I think if it opens a door into a conversation, then it's really helpful, whatever language we use. And if you realize that, you know, if you learn that the people that you want to help or you want to work with or you want to attract into having a conversation, you know, whatever language you put on that, if that opens a door into a conversation, then I don't have an issue with people using the language that opens the door to that. I mean, there's some ethical components in there, but like, I think as long as you're not taking advantage of people based on going into specific pain points and then, you know, stripping them of their money, you know, that's not the intention of like any coach that I like. I mean, I know there's some weird people out there, but like the vast majority of coaches right. I meet are really good people. They really have their heart in the right place. They want to help. They want to support. They want to support people. You know, if it opens the door, great. They're not going to make a decision based on terminology on your website. They're going to make a decision on how does this space feel like? What's the relationship like? Can I trust this person? Do I get the feeling that this kind of conversation, more of these kind of conversations could help? You know, and that's kind of I made my peace with a lot of marketing out there from that perspective. And that really helped me. So that's what made me think about it as you were musing on the spot of, well, what does that actually mean to me?
What is it? I love that. Yeah, and I think a lot of them, in some ways, new coaches are kind of a vulnerable population that get marketed to with unhelpful ideas about that in some way, like prey on a kind of potential, like, feeling of desperation and not, you know, you're entering the field and people are telling you you have to niche, you have to make yourself a this kind of coach so that people can find you or whatever. I question a lot of the marketing at new coaches that happens. And I think when we become more mature, more experienced coaches, a lot of unlearning has to happen after basic coach training as we come into our own. About how we've learned to work with ourselves as coach, you know, how we've learned to use ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Wow, David, we could talk for many more hours, and I hope we will.
I really enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, I do have an eye on the time, though, so I want to let you go for now. I will be on your case. But as we are closing this, I wonder if there's any kind of message you want to send to coaches. And I'm also wondering if people really liked what they heard from you today. Maybe they want to enter a supervision group, or maybe someone in an organization feels like, oh, that psychoanalytic stuff, I think that could be really helpful. What do you want to tell coaches out there, and where can people get closer into your sphere?
I'm very available on LinkedIn, and I'm always down to have a conversation. I do work. I have a number of supervision groups, and I work with people individually. So I'm always up for that kind of work. I'm talking about that kind of work. Mm-hmm. I guess what do I want to tell coaches? Whether with me or someone else, find a supervisory arrangement. I think largely what we don't learn in coach training, but that seems to be true, is that this work is, there's an oral tradition in the helping professions in coaching. And it is really only transmitted through being in relationship with our teachers and our supervisors and in our beloved communities of practice through relationship. And so I think part of what makes us well-resourced and able to enjoy our work is that we're partaking in the relational oral tradition, that the tacit knowledge about how to do this work well is handed to us, is transmitted to, you know, through the relationships we're in. So I would advocate to, just for the field's sake, for your sake, for the enjoyment of this work's sake, to get into relationship with a supervisor or a supervision group or a community of practice and be with one another. That would be my broad message.
I love
it. Tell stories. Tell each other stories about the work you're doing and what it means to you and what you're learning about yourself and your clients.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you so much, David, for your time, for your work, for your passionate engagement with, you know, questions, terminology, psychoanalysis, coaching. I appreciate you. So thank you for making time.
I appreciate you too. Thank you. It's great to speak. spend time together.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.